Thank you for coming. Thank you to Dave and the department for inviting me. And this is new work. It's new work in two ways. It's new work in the sense that I'm chairing a department now, so I get to pick it up every 6 months and look at it and go, oh, this looks new. But it's also new in the sense that it's developing, and so I really appreciate the opportunity to kind of trot it out here and see what happens. So I'll just start, and if I feel the need to sort of fill in something that should have come in an introduction, I'll sort of backtrack a little bit. In the first season Twilight Zone episode, A Stop at Willoughby, James Daly played Gart Williams, a 38-year-old mid-level account executive at a New York advertising agency, harried at work by the loss of a major automobile account, henpecked at home by his wife's bitter dissatisfaction with the achieved level of their suburban existence. Gart Williams uses his commuting time on the New Haven line to dream of Willoughby, a lovely little village where a man can slow down to a walk and live his life full measure. And it's July, summer, and it's 1888. So this being a Twilight Zone episode, if you're familiar at all with the series, you know what happens. But this is the white male, middle class, middle management, mid-century American dream. To have a job that you hate just enough that you can stand going back every day and that allows you to dream of another finer time and finer place. But of course, by 1888, cities already stood as symbols of dismay and decrepitude. Who in their right mind would ever choose to live in one? They were creatures of the dictates of capital and industry. Robert Lind, co-author of Middletown, the classic sociological study of Muncie, Indiana, wrote in 1932 that great urban aggregations develop for reasons that are in the main extraneous to the personal needs of men, women, and children. Or as Stephen Johnson put it in his exploration of the London cholera epidemic of 1854, the idea of the modern metropolis, quote, gave rise to an intuitive sense that the city itself was best understood as a creature with its own distinct form of volition, the uncanny feeling that somehow humans themselves were not in control of the urbanization process. And that's a process that had been changed forever by the Industrial Revolution. In 1800, it required 344 hours of manual labor to produce 100 bushels of corn to market. In 1935, that requirement had been reduced to 108 hours, and by 1965, it required only 7 hours of human labor to produce 100 bushels of corn. As this need for human involvement in food production plummeted, so did the number of farm workers employed in rural areas. Cities swelled with relocated country folk, and this is from censuses. This is the decline in the number of farm workers from 1920 to 1980. These relocatees were, as Archibald Henderson wrote, relentlessly fed into the insatiable maws of huge factories and giant plants. And this is the shift in from census to census in urban versus rural place of living, I guess. That's not English, but anyway. This intensifying relocation from farm to factory and mounting consolidation of capital power under the roofs of unprecedentedly huge limited liability corporations was accompanied by massive upheavals in population throughout the world. The growth of American cities was predicated in part on this upheaval. Earlier industrial waves of immigration had emanated from Ireland, Germany, and the UK. In the early 20th century, the center moved eastward towards Russia, Austria, Hungary, and Italy. Cities had always been considered to be vectors of disease, poverty, crime, substandard housing, sin, corruption, and rude awakenings of every sort. Places where human relations were cruelly reduced to the most brutal common denominators of market transactions. Now, on top of that, they were feared as backdrops for Bolshevism, anarchy, and political violence. Indeed, modernity, which was meant to free mankind from guilt or pain, as Shelley phrased it, had brought instead the motorized pandemonium of choking cities, insufferable poverty, world war, and economic depression. The cities of industrial capitalism had sundered everything. There was the density, for one thing. Manhattan today, since that's where I'm coming here from. Manhattan today is a very crowded place. It has houses about a dozen people per 5,000 square feet of space. In 1910, the density was 21 people per 5,000 square feet of space. And on the Lower East Side, where recent immigrants could be crowded into windowless tenement rooms by the handful, the density was 70 people per 5,000 square feet of space. Between 1921 and 1928, the number of people in the United States living in apartment houses more than doubled, from 24.4% to 58.3%. By the mid-1920s as well, and that's on this chart, by the mid-1920s as well, the building of multifamily dwellings had grown to surpass that of both one and two family houses combined. The New York Times worried that becoming a nation of apartment house dwellers, as they called it, might cause an increase in the sense of impermanence already strong among Americans. The Literary Digest commented on the hardship on dogs and other pets, which are rapidly being ostracized to the grief of many a child. Presumably, the automobile enables the apartment house dweller to get back to nature, they put that in quotes, But this, too, is at the expense of an increased sense of transiency. Gart Williams's Twilight Zone commute in from Westport every working morning was matched by more than a million others as Manhattan's daytime population swelled to double, more than 3 million people, brought in by trains, as Stuart Chase observed in 1925, from places where they would rather not live to places where they would rather not work. And there was the traffic. There were 5 automobiles registered in the United States in 1895. In 1928, there were 21,308,159. By 1930, the number of automobiles in the United States exceeded by 3 million the combined total of horses, asses, mules, and burros used in the United States in 1900. Without uniform traffic codes, automobile deaths in 1930 exceeded by 60% the total number of deaths in the Revolutionary War, Civil War, War of 1812, and World War I combined. A.J. Penty, who was a conservative critic of capitalism, wrote, "There is no single thing, in my opinion, which has proved itself so destructive of social values as the automobile. The introduction of railways had a revolutionary effect, but it kept to its tracks. It touched life at the circumference. But the automobile gets everywhere. It has shaken life at its very center, changing our personal and mental habits, our manners and morals to an extent the railway did not. It has destroyed all repose. As a result of its influence, countless men have come to live for speed and the worship of speed, like everything, like the worship of money, power, success, or bigness, is a worship that excludes everything else. It empties life of its contents and leaves men restless, dissatisfied, and bored." In short, for all the compromise, all the promised conveniences and amenities of city life, industrialized urban centers also posed a threat to what were considered to be older, time-honored, more stable forms of human sociability. According to Robert Lind, the spectacular advances of metropolitan life have concerned primarily the material aspects of our culture, transportation, building, construction, and so on. The non-material aspects, habits of thought, feeling, and action, indispensable to give, and this is an important phrase, I think, indispensable to give coherent functioning to the whole, have lagged as usual far behind. In fact, one of the most striking characteristics of metropolitan life is its tendency to slough off the non-material folkways and mores that have served in simpler environments. The bustling, impersonal culture no longer incorporates so tolerantly certain homely heritages of an earlier era. So thinking about, I forgot I had this slide. This is a prediction in 1922 of what was going to happen to arterial highways leading into New York City from the suburbs over the next 40 years, as the increase in automobile traffic continued to rise. So this idea of coherent functioning of the whole has a link to the way people thought about musical expression. In other words, all of this, in a certain regard, gets turned into, in some instances, a discussion about how people should sound when they play music. The way people considered the effects of urban lifeways on the community making expression of the homely heritages of rural areas can be found in Bertrand Bronson's thoughts on the genesis of folk song. "The strength of folk melody," this is Bronson writing, "the strength of folk melody lies in the fact that it has undergone and survives a most exacting kind of communal challenge." His emphasis. "Fresh musical suggestions within the orbit of an accepted tradition are continually being thrown off by individual creative impulse. They are as continually being met by a challenge of a homogeneous community, immersed in the traditional melodic conventions that circumscribe folk song, and only those suggestions that meet with general acceptance have a chance to survive." Without overtly calling attention to it, Bronson's definition makes cities an improbable, if not impossible, space for the generation of folk song. Cities were heterogeneous communities. in which people were separated from the conventions of accepted traditions and replaced those, as the story went, with the accepted conventions of popular music and Tin Pan Alley, or increasingly in the art music world, the conventions of what became known as the standard repertoire. The problem of the city, then, was often framed as an aesthetic and ethical problem. How can we continue to produce the valued expressions of human creativity in the dense, malevolent context of industrial urbanity? Once upon a time, the story went, people danced around the maypole. Or, as Wilfred Mellers put it in describing works of Percy Grainger's that were based on folk themes, it reminds us in the very music he recreated that the happy tribes of folk sang and danced that they might have life more abundantly. The abundance of that life was linked to and constituted by the kind of community in which the happy folk lived, which functioned as a whole. Communities in this sense were marked by the kinds of musical practices that accompany labor, but are not necessarily themselves labor. Mara Krasinski and his colleagues have documented with some care the history of singing at work, walking songs, spinning songs, weaving songs, plowing songs, and its replacement with music in the workplace under industrialization, a shift accelerated after World War II when loudspeakers systems had been installed in factories. In other words, during the war, a lot of companies came in and installed emergency loudspeaker systems in factories, and then when the war ended, they needed to find new uses for those loudspeaker systems, and there was a lot of work that was done on sort of the positive benefits of piping music in to the factory for your workers. In sort of exploring this, I stumbled across a musicologist named Charles Hughes, who taught at Hunter College, got his PhD at Columbia in 1933, taught at Hunter College for the rest of his career, except for the part during which he was blacklisted for having been a member of the Communist Party. He eventually got his job back with back pay and interest. And he passed away in 1999. So he was born in 1900 and lived the entire century. So his dissertation was about chamber music in the role of chamber music in American education. And in that, he described the musical life of the Vermont village where he had settled for his summers. And then he says, it would be a favored urban situation where so large a percentage of the inhabitants make music as in this Vermont village. And participation is what he's interested in. Participation is at the center of his work on chamber music and education. And the kind of participation you get from playing chamber music and expressing yourself as part of a small group, as opposed to being in an orchestra where you are obeying the dictates of the conductor, right? How can educators ensure continued participation in musical activity by those who do not continue on to professional careers as performing musicians? Hughes compared the village to the city in this regard. The growth of industry which gave us our factories, our elaborate machine-made existence of today, has not only aided in developing the music of today, it has at the same time destroyed the arts which had been spontaneous among the people for untold generations. Which is a really interesting turn of phrase. Folk songs, handicrafts, dances always had found a place in the lives of the cottagers, farmers, and the folk of the countryside. These things clung together and made an inseparable whole. As men worked less at home and were drawn more and more to cities and to factories instead of handwork, the old way of living began to disappear. Machine-made clothes were cheaper. The country wife no longer wove her own cloth. City songs were more up to date than the songs the old men and women sang. The grandsons no longer listened to the traditional tunes. Finally, the whole fabric of folk life broke and disappeared and left nothing with which really took its place. Pete Seeger offered a similar historical justification for why he always encouraged audience participation in his concerts. Consider the matter historically, he wrote in Sing Out magazine in the 1950s. It is only within the comparatively recent history of the human race that such emphasis has been put upon professional solo singers. In primitive tribes, all songs, except for the long narratives of the storytellers, were sung by everyone. If a song had a chorus, everybody in the audience naturally sang it, by which I think he simultaneously means naturally everyone sang it, but he also means everyone sang it naturally. Seeger linked these ideas of community to democracy, as Hughes did in distinguishing the participation of chamber music from the participation in orchestral playing. An auditorium with the seats placed semicircular wise is a more democratic auditorium than one where the seats are all in conventional straight lines, he wrote. Why? Because the latter assumes that all wisdom and inspiration must come from the front. Thank you very much. Actually, these are sort of semicircular, I take it back. And that members of the audience have nothing to contribute to one another. Most democratic of all were the council fires of early communal societies. Then anyone could stand up in place and address his or her fellow citizens. When society became more autocratic, the lines of seats straightened out. The earliest churches in America were aware of this and consciously faced pews in from the sides so worshipers could see one another. Similarly, folk music concerts and hootenannies should always use a democratically semicircular seating. When everyone joins in on a chorus, there is a mutual lift from seeing each other. And so you start to get, there's also this sense of sort of a normal society and an abnormal society, right? And sort of like the small rural community is presented as the normal society. A normal society, this again is A.J. Penty, a normal society would be one in which its people shared a common life. They would be held together by personal and human ties in the family, the parish, the guild, town and village, rather than by the impersonal activity of the state. So there are many ways of talking about this, but one of the classic ways to sort of talk about it in terms of, you know, Gemeinschaft and Gesellschaft. And one of the interesting things is that when Tonya's sort of set up that distinction, there are all these other distinctions that sort of line up with it, such that communities on the sea are more Gemeinschaft than communities inland. On streams are arteries of communication more than isolated communities. Communities in valleys are more Gemeinschaft than communities in mountains. City people more than town people. Capital cities more than provincial cities. Metropolises more than other cities. Craftsmen more than peasants. Worldly rulers more than religious leaders. And capitalistic leaders more than landed nobility. Right? And so all of those distinctions sort of add up to this idea that cities express Gemeinschaft. The worry about changing forms of participation in musical communities was especially focused on the industrial division of labor that made some people musicians and others audience members. Charles Hughes linked this participatory problem to the emergence of the virtuoso performer and the cultural institution of the public concert for sale. Otto Meissner, who is a composer and an educator early in the 20th century, asked, what should schools do for the unmusical child? And he said, as for the really unmusical child, the future Philistine, I cannot believe that there are many of them. Music is universal in its appeal. We find music in one form or another all over the world, even among our most primitive peoples, peoples with no advancement in civilization, with no written language, who yet employ music in their ritualistic exercises, even though it may appear only in rhythmic form. And this idea of music as sort of a common possession of all human beings. That music is not, I said earlier that this idea that music accompanies labor, there are work songs, but that music itself is not necessarily labor. One of the reasons for that, I think, is that in that way of framing it, music is something that all people do, right? You don't need to be a specialist in order to participate in music. And this is an attitude about music that's echoed by Percy Grainger at the beginning of the 20th century, by John Blacking in the middle of the 20th century, by Christopher Small also in the middle of the 20th century, right? And so there are sort of like, there are kind of lateral discussions that are going on. In other words, one person agreeing or disagreeing with another person at a particular time, but then there are also these sort of like longitudinal resonances, right? So Percy Grainger said what we should have is concerts of world music. We should have concerts of world music where people would be exposed, for example, to all sorts of all sorts of singing, so that we can understand what the human capacity, right? It's like what makes us human beings, so that we can understand what the human capacity for something called vocal is by listening to singers who, how does he put it, who haven't been spoiled by technique, right? There's an anti-opera kind of bent to this, that the sort of the technique of grand opera singing is seen as something to sort of push back against, and folk music is one of the ways of doing it. So there's a musical form of this sort of anti-industrialism and anti-urbanism. I'll just quickly read Huntley Carter's description of the Lancashire enclosure, because it sort of brings the aesthetics back into this. It rests beneath the blight of perpetual night. Tall shafts uplift a shroud of black smoke against its sky. Black arid wastes, sodded with horrible black naked mounds, flow in all directions, intersected by rows and rows and rows of little flat, featureless, and unutterably dreary black dwellings in which men, women, and children wilt and wither and waste, pledged to the hopeless drudgery of producing machine-made utensils, clothes, household goods, vehicles, and in fact, the necessities and comforts, so-called, of civilized life. This waste is really the symbol of the production of utilities without art. It is the mark of the beast that flourishes in our midst, the mark of the monster called machinery. That nothing beautiful or lasting ever came out of the maws of this creature is clear when one remembers it is impossible to impart to machinery human attributes to which belong the pleasures of firsthand production. And he goes on from there. And part of this is sort of shows up as well in a question about whether something called urban folklore can exist. This is an idea that was accepted in the United Kingdom and in Europe earlier than it was in the United States. But whether cities could be centers for the production of folklore. And British writers, especially Marxist British writers, are very quick to sort of accept the idea that there is folklore being produced in urban areas and something called urban folklore. Whereas in the United States, there's a bit of resistance to that, and the idea being that what you would study in cities would be remnants. What you would study in cities would be whether a folkloric tradition was robust enough to survive in some way in the city, as opposed to the idea that cities themselves can be sort of centers of creative generation of something that would be interesting to folklorists. So the response to these problems that people saw in cities was often similarly aesthetic and artistic in scope. One response was to make cities more beautiful, or more super, as the case may be. Minna McLeod Beck, following William Morris's dictum that art should not be for the few any more than liberty should be for the few, declared that humanity must solve the problem of the city and offered a solution in 1922 that sort of put on its shoulders sort of practical applications of sort of the elements of art, form, color. She sort of divides art into sort of five elements, and if you apply those elements to city design, then you'll have sort of very nicely artistically designed cities. Another was to reject the city, either by designing towns that avoided things in the cities like grid patterns. So this is the model, the plan for a superblock in Radburn, New Jersey. And the idea is everything happens inside the superblock, and there are these streets that sort of go around the superblock, but everybody sort of pulls into their house up one of these cul-de-sacs. And what it does is it sort of avoids key points of conflict between pedestrians and vehicles that you find in a city grid pattern, which is, I say this coming from New York, people in New York City love the idea of the grid, but the grid was not created for the enjoyment of the pedestrians in New York or the motorists in New York. It was created as a convenient way for the city registry to keep track of who owned which tracts of land. And sort of the grid pattern sort of grew up around that. And so people sort of came up with ideas that were social and economic as well as architectural experiments. There are also agrarian movements, the Catholic agrarian movement, various back-to-the-land movements. Ralph Borsodi's School of Living, which continues as part of the Green Movement to this day, but was a fairly conservative idea when it first surfaced. The idea that you would grind your own wheat. And that might put some flour companies out of business, but it would put the manufacturers of home wheat grinders, so you would replace one business with another business. Still others saw both the city and both urban and rural as malformations of industrialization. So it called for sort of regional planning. And Robert Bruère wrote, again in the 1920s, we know that both the lopsided industrial life of our slum-breeding cities and the hard, stark, culturally atrophied life of the isolated farm and small towns makes rounded education and spiritual development impossible. In other words, the rurality that folklorists were celebrating, the argument is that never really existed until that's as much a child of the Industrial Revolution as urban centers. That farm and city were much more closely related prior to that. So that rural-urban split is sort of a false dichotomy also. But one of the most interesting sort of anti-urban, how is music human ideas out there is Wilfred Meller's idea that music is naturally vocal and naturally pentatonic. He came up with this idea in the 1940s, and it's in some ways a response to Schoenberg and surrealism. It's a response to what Meller objects to is that the 12-tone rows are the sort of the logical conclusion of tempering the scale. That only in a system where you can think of an A sharp and a B flat as being the same note. Can you come up with the idea that you would write sort of serialistically using all 12 of those notes? And so it's a sort of a conservative response to surrealism. But this idea that music is naturally pentatonic is something that John Shepherd sort of picked up on, and there's a chapter in Whose Music where he has these sort of elaborate triangular models that demonstrate how this all works. And of course, he was a student of Miller's, and so I'm sure that's where he got it. Miller's is convinced that music is naturally vocal. In other words, human beings sing, and that they naturally sing pentatonic scales. And he turns to the blues. He turns to Hebrew cantillation. He turns to South Asian music. He turns to medieval music, and sort of kind of the state of the art of knowledge about how various music systems work, to demonstrate that as you go around the world, everywhere you go, you find pentatonic music. And so, luckily for him, along came the Beatles. And Wilfred Mellers absolutely fell in love with the Beatles and wrote what my colleague Mike Beckerman, who taught here for a while, and says that he left a bunch of baseball abstracts in his office and he wants them back. Mellers wrote what Mike Beckerman calls perhaps the most irresponsible work of musicology ever written, which is this book called Twilight of the Gods, and it's his musicological treatment of the Beatles, who he loved. Why? Because they're vocal and they're pentatonic. And so I have a couple of examples. 1, 2, 3, 4. But you were just telling me that you know what I mean. Elevation was way beyond the bed. So how could I end with another? Oh, and I saw her stand there. And then this is what Mellers talks about this as. Rock and roll for him is what he calls music of necessity, by which he means sort of attached to ritual. And different from, rock and roll in that sense for him is different from popular music, which is sort of, you know, more Tin Pan Alley, and is not music of necessity. I have one more. And why wouldn't we want to hear it? Since she's been gone, I want no one to talk to me. It's not the same, but that's to blame. It's plain to see. So go away, leave me alone, no one of me. So this isn't the only the only way that this gets expressed. There are ways of talking about this in terms of folk music, and what Mellers is claiming is that the Beatles' links are the Beatles' links to folk music, folk musics are stronger than their links to popular music. There are ways of talking about this in terms of art music, and a turn towards performance on original instruments. And so early folk world is kind of like an alternate title that I had for this talk. So if you think about Thurston Dart's discussion of the history of instruments, if you think about, I say that like everybody's read this. Thurston Dart was a musicologist who was one of the first musicologists to sort of seriously write about historically informed performance. And he gives, for example, a history of the flute. And people who play the silver flute today talk about this instrument as being superior to these instruments because it gives you consistent volume and tone across the entire range of the instrument, as opposed to this instrument, which is made out of wood, and so as you play it, it gets wet, it gets warm, it has tuning problems, it has intonation problems. There's a key down here that gives you the low B flat that unless you have massively huge hands, you can't cover the entire hole. And so they start to sort of put these mechanisms together. And now the modern flute has solved all those problems. And Dart says, yes, solved all those problems exactly the way the Industrial Revolution solves all of these problems. They've turned it into a machine. Your fingers don't touch the holes anymore. It's a contraption. There used to be a technique for playing the piano that made it clear that what your pinky can do and what your index finger can do and what your thumb can do are not the same thing. And then along came Czerny, who said, no, the idea of learning how to play the piano is so that you can do everything with any of your fingers, right? And so whether you think of this as improvement or decline, and I'm in some ways more interested in the people who see this as a decline, the decline is seen as a sort of industrialization of what should rightly be a human endeavor, which means it should be inconsistent, it should be individual. And so here is losing my notes. Yeah. Here's a performance by, and I'm not recognizing who this is, and it's completely slipped my mind, but this is the London Early Music Consort.
David Monroe.
Pardon?
David Monroe.
Yes, David Monroe, thank you. I owe you a beer. So, this is David Monroe playing some outdoor music.
Anyway, the Crusaders managed to capture some of these strange new instruments and brought them back home to Europe, where they remained in use for over 500 years. Still, out of doors, of course.
This is a very nice sort of tapestry-laden environment in which to perform this music. But again, right? This is the piece of the early music movement that people don't talk about it quite this way anymore. I guess I should say, right? I don't want to make it sound like nothing's changed. But this is the piece of the early music movement that is looking to sort of pre-Baroque music to find, again, as with folk music, music of the people, right? Music before it kind of becomes artified. Noah Greenberg was the director of the New York Pro Musica. And Noah Greenberg was politicized in exactly the same way that Pete Seeger was politicized. He did not have a formal musical education. He was in the Merchant Marines, same union that Woody Guthrie was in, and here we have the comparison to modern versions of those instruments. Noah Greenberg's first musical directing job was as the director of the chorus of the International Ladies Garment Workers Union. And saw in, or I should say heard in medieval music, a historical counterpart to this idea of sort of music of the common people. And so I'd like to sort of like end this up by sort of talking about this kind of, this triangle that we often think of as sort of being in some kind of homeostasis, where art music, where the project of modernity is seen as sort of creating these distinctions between art music and folk music and world music. But I think what we see instead, and it's contained in this argument about what kind of music should modern people perform? How should modern, given all of these problems with the modern world, how can we redeem our universal humanity through the kinds of sounds that we make? And often what that discussion does is it offers kinds of sort of deformations of the triangle. So world music is like art music. World music is the art music of the rest of the world. And in fact, there are many music departments in which that is what world music is. World music is, like, if you're at Wesleyan or UCLA, right? World music often has been framed as we teach Western art music and we teach the art traditions of other places. We teach Japanese Koto, we teach South Indian, Veena, we teach African drumming, right? And so world musics in that sense are presented as formally art music, if not informally, as simply being sort of generalizing the term of what art is. Art music is like folk music. You find people who are dedicated to the idea that the Western art tradition is an important tradition to maintain, acknowledging that Haydn had to write so many symphonies that what he did often was borrow folk melodies and set them. That the theme of Bach's Goldberg Variations is a German drinking song, right? And you get those kinds of discussions that move the art music, the Western art music tradition, closer to the idea of being a folk music. Folk music is like an art music. There's a quote that I saw from Pete Seeger where he's talking about trips that he took with his father when he was a child and the music that they would listen to from people sitting on their front porches in North Carolina. And he says, you know, those players listen to each other as closely as any string quartet, right? And so there's that kind of analogizing being done. And of course, folk music and world music are brought together in the idea that to the extent that music is a sort of universal human endeavor, all world music is folk music, right? And in fact, Folkways Records published album after album after album after album that was, you know, folk music of Ghana, folk music of, and you fill in the blank. And all of these things, and this is the biggest distinction that's being made. all of these, as much as somebody who loved Beethoven symphonies and sort of gravitated towards art music, would argue against the sort of the repetitiveness of folk music, or wouldn't understand world music, right? And you can sort of like go around this triangle and think of those things. Even to the extent that these are three areas that are distinguishing themselves from each other, they are united in collectively preferring what they do, what any of them do, to this horrible thing called popular music. And it's popular music that becomes the villain in this, which brings me back to this, you know, this question which I'll sort of end on, of sort of what do we do then with the fact that Wilfred Mellers loved the Beatles? Because that Beatles moment, and I think to a lesser extent, that moment of you know, the sort of Dylan goes electric moment that everybody writes about with such glee. But that Beatles moment, that in some sense was the moment when a lot of these distinctions started to break down, right? That the Beatles, it was a very interesting time for colonialism, of course. The Beatles' exposure to South Asian music, for example, and circulating South Asian music on their recordings, is something that people in, you know, who are interested in world music certainly took notice of, right? And that's one of the areas where this distinction between popular music and other forms of music starts to break down. So the Beatles are sort of like this really important moment. And of course, people in the folk music revival were also had to contend with what it meant to them that they liked the Beatles. After all those years, and it, you know, after all those years of sort of excoriating rock and roll and popular music, that along came this band that a lot of people in the folk music revival actually enjoyed listening to. And a number of them had to struggle with what that meant for their ideas about what music was. And so that moment when the Beatles sort of like explode onto the scene is a really important moment for me for thinking about these things. I think I've probably taken up enough time, and I know that I've rushed through some things, but I will leave it there. And if we want to do some questions and answers, I'm happy to sort of go back and try to fill in some blanks. Thank you. How they become rigid, but I know that the fact that the rigidity is a piece of what's going on here. So this is the piece, and I did my best to avoid using this word because I think this word is actually a red herring. This is the part, in a sense, where the idea of authenticity sort of comes into play. And I think authenticity is actually a cover for what's really going on. And as I've said, what I think is really going on is people aren't saying, how can we play music more authentically? I think what people are really worried about is how can we continue to express ourselves as human beings? And they find in certain categories of music the answer to that question. And to the extent that those categories threaten to become sort of polluted by other categories, that's a problem for the larger, in a sense, for the larger argument, I guess. And so if you think about John and Alan Lomax, I realized the other day when I was looking online, there is a two-volume set of recordings called Prison Songs. Library of Congress recordings 1947 to 1948, Volume 1 and Volume 2, because that's where the Lomaxes went. That's where the Lomaxes found Leadbelly. Why did they go there? Because John Lomax was convinced that in that sort of Gemeinschaft, Gesellschaft way, John Lomax was convinced that if he went to communities that had sort of been isolated from the mainstream, that he would find music that had not been corrupted by exposure to radio and records and jazz, right, and ragtime, and so that's the reason why, and so sort of the history of the incarceration of African American men is such a huge kind of like underlying substructure of the history of thinking about what authentic folk music is and what authentic experience is. So I think in that sense there were always these kind of purifying moves that were going on. One writer who I read, who I didn't realize this was going to be a question, so I can't call the name to mind, went back and looked at the actual lists of songs that were sung for a number of folklorists who collected for the Library of Congress, and found that that their repertoires actually included a pretty good number of popular songs, and then those songs were sort of cleansed from the record, right? Because folklorists were making decisions. I mean, you've got somebody who plays the fiddle. And they play the fiddle at dances. And one of the things you need to do if you play the fiddle at dances is have a huge repertoire of songs that you're going to play, because you don't want to repeat yourself too much. And they would play anything. And then a folklorist would come along, and as Francis Densmore said, my technique, when I'm in the field, my technique is to find the oldest Indians I can and ask them to sing the oldest songs they can remember, right? And that's how this sort of editorial purification process goes on. And so the importance of keeping this category, is part of that. And then on the flip side of it, well, you know, popular music, that was just a, first of all, one of the things that the people in the folk music revival liked about the Beatles is that they composed their songs on the guitar and not the piano, right? The piano was sort of seen as the Tin Pan Alley instrument. And it's, you know, some guy in an office on 14th Street who can only play in one key and sort of churns out, you know, three songs a day, and they all have the same chord changes, all the stuff that Adorno rightly complains about, right? And that was what popular music was sort of seen as. The idea was, and this is something that Henry Krabiel wrote early in the century, in like 1915. Henry Cabille was one of the earliest people to take African American music seriously. He wrote a very early treatment of African American song, and he said basically, folk music is written by the people, and popular music is written for the people. Right? And it's kind of Lincoln-esque, because there's an of the people in there too somewhere. But of course, given that choice, that's what you would, you know, of course you would prefer something that was written by the people to something that was written for the people. Right? And Tin Pan Alley was just churning these things out left and right, and throwing spaghetti at the wall and hoping some of it would stick, right? And so there's two culprits here. One is opera singing, as I said, and the other is sort of that kind of classic Moon June Swoon kind of Tin Pan Alley songwriting.
Gilbert talks about the creation of the art concept and the folk concept being simultaneous in the late 18th century, which fits pretty well with your idea of looking a bit before that to the Baroque period for connections to folkiness and what became the lineage of art music. So have you looked at his work, and what do you think about the way he kind of historicized the creation of the folk concept, and as it turns out, the art concept in music scholarship?
To be honest with you, I haven't. I'd love to know if we can sort of chat a little bit afterwards. I'd love to know about it, because most of what I've been doing has been sort of diving into sort of the contemporaneous writers. And one of the things that's interesting is the extent to which, especially the sort of, there's a rightist critique of industrial capitalism that my sense is sort of disappeared around World War II, because they made the mistake of getting into bed with fascists. They saw something positive in what was going on in Germany and Italy, which gives them. But how the extent to which it's a movement filled by not musicians necessarily, but filled by artists. William Morris is in that group. A.J. Penty was an architect. Eric Gill was an architect and actually designed this typeface, right? And so the extent to which and I'm not sure I'm sort of addressing your question, but I've been struck in the reading that I've been doing, the extent to which there's worry about the aesthetics of the movement, because so many of the people involved in it are artists, but artists in a way that I think we would accept as sort of being high art. They're painters, they're poets, they're architects. And so their sense that art, right, in that sort of elevated sense, their sense that art sort of comes from the bottom up is I think a really important part of that. Of that movement. And so it's not clear to me that they made this sort of, I think in some ways they object to that art folk distinction. But again, I'm not familiar with the work.
Oh yeah, I think it plays out very differently in music than it does in some material arts, where there are some similarities. And what I like about the way you presented this that I think differs from Galbraith's work, to the extent that I understand it, is the linking to the Industrial Revolution and the rethinking of some basic society in a way. understand better.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of the work that I have looked at that's looking at this is in a sense talking about it in terms in sort of very fairly, to me at least, very fairly familiar terms of the kind of waxing and waning style. And to the extent that there's a relationship between high art and folk, it's sort of traced in the sort of rise and fall of sort of particular performers or particular composers. And I think in a certain sense, I'm trying to think about what the sort of pedal point that sort of hearable beneath all that stuff might be, right? Which is one of the reasons why I've become really attracted to the way that what somebody said in 1983 is so resonant with what somebody else said in 1923. And for all that the world has changed in those 60 years, there's still something about how music should sound and how music should express sort of human creativity that sort of continues through all of those changes. And in a certain sense, what's attracting me in this work is sort of like thinking about what those through points are. Because I don't want to say everybody's just always saying the same thing, but it sometimes feels that way. In a sense, I'm doing an archaeology of my own education, right? That I read, I read John Blacking, and John Blacking was presented to me as sort of, this original, and he is. I mean, I'm not denying that for a second. But John Blacking is sort of presented. I guess I should say John Blacking is presented when you're studying ethnomusicology as a kind of a singular voice. And he may be a singular voice within ethnomusicology, but his ideas are coming from somewhere. And when I read, something that there's a composer, he's a California-based composer named Dane Rudyard. I think he was located in San Francisco. When I read something that he wrote in 1926. That you could sort of like interchange with something that's in How Musical Is Man, that Blacking wrote in the 1970s. Those are sort of these note points that I'm kind of collecting in that way.
Blacking was also critiquing his own. Blacking was also coming to terms with his own education.
Yeah.
You said you were an important part of this.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about it, but one piece that I thinking about, pedagogy and continuity of ideas and similarity of the ideas, I thought about the drive for preservation that's, a dominant part of the story that, maybe this doesn't have, your story you're telling now doesn't have as much to do with, which is the idea that, we are going to, save the lore and put it away and, have us, two of each time in the arc. And that kind of thing, rather, much of what you're talking about is the conscious generation of attitudes and ideas in order to perpetuate that triangle and various, various forms and keep the points in place. And one of the things that preservation assumes is that those points are going to, or whatever the crucial points of culture are going to, be gone soon. And that we need to have, examples of these in order to be able to recreate later, rather than cultivate, a lot. So those are really different, standpoints. points, I wondered if, you know, what your take on, you know, not just the lone accidents, what they were, with the continuities they were addressing, but there are the other aspects of the presentation.
Yeah, well, I mean, they're certainly worried about this stuff disappearing, because if this stuff disappears, it says something about us as people.
Right.
You know, and but you don't want to just sort of like preserve it in amber. You need to, right? The trick is that you need to keep it, because if it's only preserved in amber, that also says something about us as people.
Right.
And so the trick is to sort of find ways to generate it, which is why, and I'm not, I guess, I don't know if I'm going to make enemies here, I'm not a Pete Seeger fan, but I find Pete Seeger such a fascinating character. Because like the stuff that I read, he says these things with this incredible authoritativeness that's always mixed with a lot of self-deprecation, because he never claims to be authentic, right? He always says, I'm an entertainer, right? And I'm doing what I can to help people understand these things. But if you want to know how this music really sounds, you need to listen to these people and these people and these people, right? There was, and sort of his role in the kind of modern music machine, right? Always strikes me as, well, I guess I shouldn't say always, but often enough that I can say always, always strikes me as something that he had a great deal of trepidation about. And that trepidation I find really, really fascinating. My gears are turning thinking about sort of what you're
I think what I'm trying to say is that, you know, I'm compelled by your way of framing it, which is that there's a need to understand modernity and frame the things in this way, but is there any room for there being an object that needs to be preserved, like a song or a way of performing or a way of life that is distinct from modernity that you know can be kept and reproduced in the like a back to the you're talking earlier about back to the land.
You know, I don't feel that among the musicians, but there are all these, you know, all kinds of sort of movements to preserve the rural lifeways or return to rural lifeways. And when we were talking about this earlier when we were walking around, the politics of these things is so malleable over time. I mean, one of the things that got me interested in this was I discovered this musicologist who was blacklisted for being a communist. And I read a review of his book. He wrote a book that was published in the 1940s called The Human Side of Music. And the reviewer sort of like kind of rakes the book over the coals a little bit for its clearly Marxian approach to art. And I've read the book, and I have to say this sort of like as somebody who was raised on Janet Wolfe, right? or what have you, that whatever Marxist approach to art is in that book is so buried that I don't know how this reviewer discovered that. But then he says, at his most anti-capitalistic moments, basically, Hughes calls for a return to the wandering minstrel stage of artistic production. And I thought, well, that's really fascinating, because where in the world does Marx say that the solution to the problem of industrial capitalism is to return to the stage of wandering minstrels, right? And so the idea that Pete Seeger was blacklisted for having been a member of the party, which isn't the same thing as having been a communist, right? It's like the way I might be a registered Democrat, right? I guess. Ooh, sorry. But if Pete Seeger, I think you have to look pretty far and wide in Marx to find anything that would lead you to believe that what the workers of the world need to do is learn how to play the banjo. Right? Marx was not anti-industrialist. Marx just thought the wrong people were unjust. I mean, you know, Marx thought the wrong people were in charge, but it's not. Marx doesn't call for, but the agrarian movements say, no, capitalism, industrial capitalism is bad, and the answer is we need to go back to the, there's this sort of like return to feudalism, kind of, that feudalism was actually a more egalitarian way of when people knew their place. Right, I mean, there's all kinds of, but I don't find it. I haven't found it. I find it around musicians, but I don't find musicians sort of talking about that, with the possible exception of somebody like Mike Seeger, right, and the New Lost City Ramblers, who really like did sort of like deep study, and did their best to perform rural southern folk music in the style of rural southern folk, even though they were all Ivy League educated Northeasterners.
I'm here all night. Great. Well, maybe we'll move out to the courtyard.
Yeah.